So we're here again doing a midweek podcast with Michael Hughes, Joshua Cutchin, and Red Pill Junkie. How are you guys?
Fantastic.
Swell.
Swell as well. Really psyched. Really excited after returning from the movies.
And what movie was that?
Ooh, Batman versus Superman.
And you give it a thumbs up, huh?
And give it 4.5 red pills out of 5.
Wow. All right.
It's a lot
Mike,
of red pills.
We haven't talked to you in a while.
Yeah, Matt, it's good to be back.
So is your new book done?
Oh, it's so close. It will be done this weekend. I've just got to tweak a couple of the revisions, so I'm very happy to say it will be off to my editor, who will be very, very happy to have it.
Nice.
And it's good, man. It's all about magic and it's craziness and apocalypse and all that stuff we like.
And congratulations, man.
You think you didn't intentionally write a bad book?
Well, I mean, you know, according to me, it's not a bad book, but, you know, we'll see what everybody else thinks.
And this is the third of the trilogy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And the third book's always where you know, you really have to nail it or people get pissed.
Stick to it.
Because they invest a lot of time.
Isn't the second book the most difficult to write?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the second book in this trilogy, Witchlights, I think was actually better than the first book. So, so we'll see what people say about the third. But, you know, I'm happy with it.
You don't have a dancing Ewoks at the end of the
No, you know, I thought about throwing some little fuzzy dancing creatures in there, but then something told me I probably shouldn't.
All right, so tonight we're going to be dealing with the subject of night terror and sleep paralysis and all the stuff that this connects to. And I started wanting to do a show on this, not only because we amongst ourselves have talked about some of this stuff before. Mike has talked about one of his experiences, but there's a movie called The Nightmare. And it's a documentary with some reenactments of these things. And it's the same guy that did what, Room?
237.
Which was about, I have it and I've never watched it.
Yeah, it's about the people's kooky theories about The Shining, what The Shining means and what Kubrick was, you know, everything from, you know, the space, you know, fake space missions to, you know, Native American something. And it's crazy.
Was it any good?
I thought it was going to be more fun than it turned out to be. In my opinion, it was a little tedious.
Huh. Okay.
I think I watched part of it and it was good, but it was, you know, showing people connecting the dots too hard, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly. Wait,
overanalyzing every single aspect of every single frame in that movie.
Yeah, when connecting the dots, you can connect the dots that are a mile apart. It just just doesn't make much sense.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's kind of a good study in conspiratorial psychopathology.
Huh. Mm-hmm. All right.
But a bit tedious, I found.
Unlike The Nightmare. And I found this to be an excellent movie. Friend of mine recommended it to me, and I watched it, and he told me what it was, and I guess it didn't really click that it was a documentary, and I'm watching it, and I'm like, this is really well done, and it brings up some really interesting questions. And it is available on Netflix for anyone who hasn't seen it. I would definitely recommend watching it.
Absolutely, and
preferably a day, preferably in detail. Because if you watch it at night and you happen to live alone, then you're probably not going to have any sleep.
Yeah, the first time that I watched it, I was actually at home alone. My wife was out on a business trip, and I did not have a great night that night, that's for sure. But, you know, a couple of things. I mean, the director, whose name is Rodney Asher, I would love to see him tackle a traditional horror film at some point, because his staging and his eye for visuals and his timing actually are absolutely fantastic, and I would love to see him really approach that. But even more than that, it was an incredibly refreshing take on it, because you see something like The Nightmare, and you think it's going to go in there, and it's going to provide a very materialistic explanation for these sort of experiences, and that's not at all what he does. It's almost like he sets up his camera, and he says, hey, tell me about what you've experienced. And he builds recreations around that, and it's harrowing. It's absolutely engaging, and it's refreshing in the way that it doesn't make judgments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
agreed.
Yeah,
I kept waiting for the, you know, the sleep research scientist to
exactly,
come
yeah,
and kind of explain it all away, and it was refreshing that it didn't take that tack. You know, it just let people tell their stories.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it definitely brings up some questions that the standard explanation for sleep paralysis goes something like, you're starting to wake up or you're starting to fall asleep, but your conscious brain doesn't go to sleep, but the parts of your brain that control your movement and stuff shut off as if it's asleep. And then mm-hmm. you start having dream imagery while you're still awake, and that's the explanation for these type of things. But mm-hmm. there's a lot of stuff that's been brought up here. And experiences that I know Mike has had, particularly one, that makes you think there's something more going on. The standard explanation may work 50%, 80% of the time, but there's definitely something else here. And there's a lot of connections to other stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And particularly with UFOs, a lot of UFO debunkers will say people aren't getting abducted. They're just having night terrors, except that, of course, it doesn't always happen when they're sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and night terrors, you know, or sleep paralysis doesn't, you know, shouldn't, if it's just a physiological condition, shouldn't leave physical traces.
Right. You know? Actually, Mike, why don't you tell people what happened with you?
Yes, please.
So that they have that.
Yeah, and okay. This was 1996, I know, because there was a crazy blizzard that year. There were actually two snowstorms that rolled in, and one after the other. And I happened to be in West Virginia with a girlfriend of mine at a bed and breakfast. And we were one night, I have to preface this, that at the time I was experimenting with melatonin, which is a hormone naturally occurring in the human body. A lot of people were taking it in the 90s for like life extension purposes, but mostly people took it for sleep. And I started taking it to help me fall asleep. And I found out that it really kicked up my dreams, like to an extraordinary degree, that I was having just these insanely complicated, intensely emotional dreams that were just, you know, incredible plots that I would have a hard time coming up with, you know, if I sat down and tried to do it. So while I'm with, you know, my girlfriend, we got snowed in at this bed and breakfast in West Virginia near Berkeley Springs. And I was taking probably about 30 milligrams of melatonin, which is about 10 times the average dose that people are taking in. But the thing is, it's not psychoactive, though. You know, it's not a psychoactive drug. I mean, if you ask any pharmacologist, you know, what taking that much would do, they'd say, you know, I don't know, nothing really. You know, it doesn't act on any of the normal, you know, systems that you know, or the agonist or the, you know, the receptors that cause, you know, psychoactive sort of symptoms like hallucinogenic or psychedelic or otherwise.
Right.
But
when Strassman did his DMT work, that's one of the things they looked into, what an effect melatonin had as far as like hallucinatory effects or anything like that. And he said he phoned up whatever research laboratory and they'd given this guy this huge dose of melatonin. And they're like, is he hallucinating? And they're like, nope, he just doesn't want to get back up.
Yep. yeah, and actually it has kind of a paradoxical effect in a lot of ways. Like for some people, and including myself, sometimes it keeps me wide awake and I can't sleep. As a matter of fact, my wife was taking it recently for sleep, you know, in a very small, you know, normal dose, and it kept her awake all night. You know, she was in like sort of a twilight sleep. But anyway, that's so, you know, just to preface this with, I was taking a very, very large dose of melatonin, which is a tryptamine, Soraya. So, you know, it is related, chemically related to DMT and psilocybin, things like that. But it's not it's not a psychoactive drug, although there is speculation that it's produced in the pineal gland, which is related to the, you know, the mystical third eye and stuff like that. So there's all this kind of, you know, mythological stuff around melatonin.
Yeah, but there's, you know, there's something attached to it in some way, I'm convinced.
I think so too.
Yeah.
So I'm taking a large dose of melatonin, and I went to sleep, and I woke up having an absolutely one of the most maybe the most horrifying thing that ever happened to me. A full-blown sleep paralysis, couldn't move except for my eyes, and I'm looking around the room. The room's taken on this aura of malevolence, of evil, and I know something is in the room. And that's the common, you know, thread of a lot of sleep paralysis, is that you just sense, you know, something terrible, something demonic is in the room. They call it the intruder, or a sensed presence, or whatever. And, you know, so I'm feeling this, man. I mean, I'm thinking I'm going to die, because this thing is going to rip my soul out. You know, it's not like a burglar or, a human intruder. I mean, this thing is a demon. It's the absolute most evil thing in existence. And it's there to get me. It's there to extinguish me as a person. And So, you know, it was terrifying, and I actually don't quite know how it resolved. I woke up the next day, and, you know, and so somehow I fell back asleep after this thing happened. So there was no real resolution to it. There was just this moment that felt like it was lasting forever. There was pure terror, like nothing I've ever felt before. And, you know, so what happened? You know, I fell asleep, I guess, or, you know, again, I'm not quite sure what happened. But the next morning, my girlfriend looked over at me, and she said, "What's that on your chest?" Ooh. And I said, "What?" And I looked down, and I could see like some kind of red thing on my chest. So I went in the bathroom and looked in the mirror, and there was a handprint on my chest, a red handprint. So I'm thinking, well, I must have slept on my hand, you know. I mean, it was really bright red and vivid, almost like someone had painted it on. And then I looked at it a little closer, and I tried to fit my hand to it to see if I could twist either of my hands around, you know, and neither of them really fit. And then I noticed the fingers were longer than my fingers on this handprint. And then I looked, did sort of a double take, and this is when, you know, the hackles were raised. It had six fingers, and not blurry fingers. I mean, this handprint was six distinct, vivid fingers, as if someone had dipped their hand in paint. Their six-fingered, long-fingered, large hand in paint.
Hell no.
And slapped it on my chest. And you know, I remember talking to my girlfriend. I'm like, do you see there's six fingers on this? And she's going, you know, I could tell she was getting a little freaked out by it. I think she was more freaked out that I was getting so freaked out by it. She's like, "Oh, you must have just slept on your hand." I'm like, "No, I tried to see if it would fit. And there's six fingers, you know." Mm-hmm. And you know, to this day, that is, you know, aside from seeing some weird stuff in the sky, that is truly the freakiest thing that's ever happened to me. And I you know, before I did my first podcast with Soraya, I called her up. She lives in Georgia now, and I'm like, "Hey, do you remember that? Do you?" And she's like, "Oh my God, yeah." And it turns out, you know, that I didn't know at the time, but when I called her up, she started telling me about the guy she started dating after me and actually married and had a child with, she started telling him about the six-fingered handprint incident that I had. And he started telling her about waking up with scratches on his body and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, it just the weirdness just multiplied. But so I basically called her to verify that I was remembering this all correctly. And she winds up spinning the story in another direction. I'm like, so, you know, so I had sleep paralysis, yes, but there was a physical component of some sort.
You know, that's interesting. In terms of that facet of her having experiences with both you and the gentleman that she ended up spending the rest of her life with, because, you know, in the documentary, there are a couple of people who don't have sleep paralysis until they actually end up dating someone who has sleep paralysis, and then they get sleep paralysis. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, in the film, they call it sleep transmitted disease, STD, sleep transmitted disease, or something like that. Yeah, and that was I had never heard that before until I saw the documentary. That was a kind of an eye opener.
And the question becomes, did something actually leave a handprint on you, or did your mind convince your body to create a handprint on your chest?
Or her mind.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, maybe, or her mind.
Yeah, maybe it was hers, you know, somehow. Imprinting.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, I've seen and I've read about, you know, hypnotists can, you know, tell someone they're going to touch them with a, you know, a burning hot coal or something, and touch them, you know, with a pencil eraser, and a blister will raise.
Right.
You know, and there's that scene in The Exorcist with Linda Blair, you know, when the words, you know, spell themselves out across her skin. Yeah, I mean, as you guys know, I try to remain, you know, pretty agnostic about this stuff. But all I know is that there was, you know, whatever this thing was, it wasn't from my hand. And, you know, I certainly don't have six fingers the last time I checked. So somehow it got there. And it got there in, you know, proximity to having this horrifying experience of something demonic in my bedroom.
Right. Well, and what interests me about the six fingers aspect is that I think some recent research has suggested that perhaps these figures that you see during sleep paralysis are projections of the self, that you're actually externalizing your body map. But if it has six fingers, that's not your body map. You know?
It was in the documentary, it was a guy named Jeff who had actually took some notes here so I'd remember this. He picked it up from his girlfriend. She was telling him about it. And then they were sleeping, and suddenly he started having these experiences, these sleep paralysis, and he had never had one prior to that.
Hmm.
And later on, it might have even been the same guy. I don't remember because I am horrible keeping track of names, and they only put their names at the beginning. But he said he had told someone about what was happening with him. And he just told her over the phone. He described it and stuff. And the next thing you know, she was having that experience.
Yeah, she texted him back. She's like, "You jerk," or whatever, you know. Yeah,
exactly.
Probably in less kind language. But, yeah, that's, you know, and that was an interesting aspect of the film. Like, some of these little nuances I had never heard of. And since I had that experience, and I had traditional sleep paralysis before that thankfully didn't leave handprints or anything on my body, but so I've always been fascinated by it, and I've done a lot of research and read the academic research and books and papers and, you know, pretty much everything I could get my hands on. But that, you know, that folkloric aspect I had never come across before. So that was really interesting, the idea that at least the people they interviewed, you know, whether this is common or it's just, you know, happened to these people, you know, it seems it's gotten like that, you know, that folklorish aspect to it now, that it could be transmitted to other people.
Well, it's also interesting that they talked to a very good variety of people who had different types of experiences and different thoughts about what was happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes. I remember this guy. I actually took notes about the movie when I watched it. This guy who reported these entities, which had skin like TV static.
Love that.
Yeah.
And inky eyes. So the inky eyes, you'll say, well, you know, the typical gray alien. But this idea of seeing these like static-like surface on the skin of these entities, that was something that I had never heard of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's the one that also wandered in to see his dad was watching Communion, the movie, and he saw the alien guys on there, and it shocked him because he was like, wait a minute, someone is, you know, somebody else understands this experience.
Yeah, and he is. Go on.
No, sorry. And he also made like a mask. Show what he remembered. Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, I actually made a sketch of this mask because it was so creepy. Because it was like showing a gray alien, but with us this really big, gaping, toothless mouth, wide and right. So it was like a combination of the gray alien, but with what we will call the grinning man, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was super creepy.
That's a nice little correlation there, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this is also the same guy who was with a girl that he said was a little bit out there. And they had gone into the woods, and she had her eyes closed, and she was reaching out, and there was this she's like, oh, there's this blue being here, and he could actually see the blue being.
Yeah.
And then she's relaying messages from this being, and one of them is she turns to him and says, just ignore the demons behind you. And he was like, wait, what?
Mm-hmm.
And he turned around, and there were the two things he had seen as a child standing right behind him. And this was in, for all intents and purposes, a normal state of consciousness. He wasn't asleep or anything when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was, I mean, I have to step back a little bit and say, I don't think any of these people seem like they were confabulating, you know, there was one guy that seemed, I can't remember his name, was Chris or something. He seemed a little too actorish, you know, and for me, you know, usually when you see documentaries with real people talking, it's clear that they're real people and they're not actors. But this one guy seemed very good at his style of communication.
Emotive.
Yeah. So, you know, I wouldn't say the film is like a pure, you know, documentary that I would, you know, embrace, you know. I can't really tell. I don't know enough about these people, you know, to know their what's really going on. So there was always a little my little skeptical, you know, part of my brain was just kind of sitting there going, a couple times just felt a little, you know, a little disconcerted maybe about these folks. Well, but for the most part, I think, you know, for the most part, I thought the women seemed much more, seemed the really credible ones to me. And maybe that's just some kind of prejudicial judgment in my case or something.
Well, it is not a raw fly-by-night sort of enterprise. It is a very slick and well-put-together production, so kudos to them on that. So I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that maybe perhaps they took some testimony from someone and had someone else read it in the sense of truthiness. I understand where you're coming from with that, Michael.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Chris was the one who was saying that when he was five, the television started talking to him.
Yeah, right. That's the guy.
Which kind of reminds me of something that Whitley Strieber mentions in one of his books when he actually had a conversation with someone speaking to him from his stereo system at the his New York cabin.
And I think Keel has written about similar things as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not unheard of. And I guess if that happened to you when you were five, that's probably going to stick in your mind for a while.
Oh, you think?
Well, and you know, another Keelian connection is the gentleman who picked up his phone and was having a strange phone call in the middle of the night,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think I'm the only one to have experienced. Am I the only one of the four of us to have experienced that? Maybe I am.
Voices.
Yeah, the electronic voices. And that was a really compelling little anecdote that he had. But the similarities are there again. The idea that even in this age of technology, whatever it is, prefers to use the telephone.
But that was inside of one of his sleep paralysis experiences, wasn't it?
Yeah, but there was something. Wasn't there something that made it suggestive to him that perhaps it was an actual phone call, or was it entirely?
Yeah, I think he had a phone call. And in the phone call, the last thing is, can I ask you something? Yeah, what?
Yeah, but that
let
was
me in.
Yeah, that was the sleep paralysis.
Oh,
I didn't realize it was entirely within the sleep paralysis. So I thought there was an external component too.
Nope. So yeah, that was definitely within his sleep paralysis that he got the phone call. But Josh, tell us about the phone calls you've gotten.
Well, I was the shortened version of it was that I had spent a week with my family and my then fiance at Hilton Head, South Carolina, and my parents had gone back the night before we were supposed to leave, and they'd arrived at home safely. And that evening, my wife and I had spent all day on the beach, and we had retired to bed. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, which is not a time where anyone in my family would have gotten up. I got a phone call on my cell phone, and I answered it, and it was this robotic voice that wouldn't respond to anything that I was saying, and I couldn't make out what it was saying at all, but it sounded very much akin to a speak and spell, that sort of like electronic Stephen Hawking-esque sound, but all of it was gibberish. And I closed up the phone, and I immediately called back my family, because the caller ID had originally said that it had come from my parents' phone. And mm-hmm. none of them had not made that call, and they had no idea where it had come from. So I assume that there's probably some sort of very prosaic explanation for it being some sort of crossed wires or something along those lines. But it was really odd that the caller ID was from them, and they hadn't made that phone call at a time when anybody would have been doing anything in the house. And I had this weird, bizarre mechanical voice, which sounds very Keelian, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, sort of where I landed on it with myself is that perhaps it has something to do with the sort of mental state that I was in, because this was before A Trojan Feast was published, and I was sort of in this really focused, like, I've got to get this out there. How's this going to do? I'm not sure, you know, what am I getting into? Sort of mindset. Watching. Yeah, and so I wonder if maybe in the middle of the night I had psychically projected that onto the whole thing.
Yeah, the only thing ever weird like that with me is a few times when I had spent the night at a friend's house when I was a teenager, I would get calls here, and this is before, like, this is like back in the late 80s, so we didn't have caller ID or anything, but I'd get calls with this girl asking for me that my mother had no idea who it was, couldn't identify it, said it was very hard to hear them, like they were on a really bad connection. This never happened when I was home. I have no idea who it would have been, but it only happened when I was spending the night down at a certain friend's house.
Was there anyone in your family who was a female who you were close to that had died at that point? Or?
Nope.
Interesting.
Hmm. You know, Josh, there's a. Do you know about the call that Jack Sarfatti, the quantum physicist, do you know that story?
Off the top of my head, no, I do not.
Okay, he was like 12 or 13 years old, and he got a call, and it was this robotic voice that said it was calling from a spaceship.
Yes, I have heard the story. Yeah, keep telling it. Yeah,
yeah, it wanted to teach him something if he was willing, so he said yeah. And I think he sat around with his friends, and at some point when they told him to, I'm a little hazy on the story, but he kept getting phone calls, and his mother said he would get these phone calls, and he would just sit and listen on the line and would never comment, and she got kind of worried about him. But he never recalled the phone calls. But when you said the robotic voice, that was the first thing. And again, very Keelian too, you know, very much so.
Well, yeah, and not to really overemphasize this point, but I think that there's something about telephone communication that whatever this big THIS is tends to prefer that over, you know, more electronic mediums. I mean, you don't get the same sort of spooky phantom phone call type stories about email. And if you do, it's a lot easier to dismiss them. But, it's really interesting the way that whatever it is seems to prefer to interface with that type of technology.
There seems to be an electromagnetic component in all of this. And that's something that was mentioned in this documentary, you know, people mm-hmm. seeing or perceiving some kind of static in the room, you know, or some mm-hmm. kind of like mm-hmm. Feeling this, like the atmosphere charging up. So maybe that's the reason why this phenomena has also been somehow linked or associated with telephone conversations with analog equipment like stereo, old stereos, and maybe not so much with our current digital technology. Now I'm thinking of other things, you know, thinking of how some scientists are saying that when now with our transition from analog into digital, there is going to be like this die-off of signals sent by our civilization that is going to be picked up or could be picked up by a possible extraterrestrial civilization trying to listen to signals from other places. And well, I don't know where I'm getting with all of this, but there seems to be something with electronics, electromagnetism, and maybe people who are hypersensitive to electromagnetic fields, which mm-hmm. I kind of think I am, and maybe that's something that triggers this kind of phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the other thing. A lot of those, especially some of the women who were describing how they felt before the situation happened, Anna and Corrine were two in particular, sounded all the world like they were having active Kundalini. Mm. And that interfaces directly with electronics.
Yeah, I would love to see a survey of the people who have sleep paralysis and those who have active electronics in their bedroom at night. You know, I mean, I sleep with an ionizer and I haven't had that many. I'm no stranger to sleep paralysis. I've had it happen a couple of times. I've never had an entity associated with it, but I've always been in this sort of odd state where I see the room around me, and I'm usually able to pull myself out of it and keep a level enough head that I realize what's happening to me. But really, ever since I've had an ionizer running in my room, I don't think I've really noticed it as much. So I wonder if there might be something to do with that. Which, I mean, honestly, it's an idea that I've been kicking around a long time, is that the reason that more quote-unquote primitive cultures have more interactions with the supernatural is because they aren't encapsulated by this electromagnetic bubble that we are.
Mm. Well, not only that, but the one guy was saying that to fend it off, he would put TVs in his room.
Yes,
right.
Yeah.
And he had a whole pile of TVs, and then one day he said, "This is stupid. It's still happening to me." And he took them all away, and then he said it came back with a vengeance on him.
Yeah, which reminds me of, I know that Rosemary Ellen Guiley has suggested, I don't know exactly where she gets this information, but she has suggested that the djinn are actually deterred by electronics in the bedroom. So I don't know if that has any bearing on this at all.
Interesting.
Interesting.
One of the things I noticed is that all but a couple of these people in this documentary have had weird experiences since they were very young. Like Chris with the TV talking to him. Mm. The one guy saw the staticky things come into his room when he was a child. One person was describing stuff when they were in a crib. And so that, or maybe the staticky people were in the crib. The guy who, there was one kid there who said his bed was on a slant because his mother had tons of stuffed animals under.
Mm-hmm. Beanie babies.
Beanie babies, thank you. And the frame was broken, and so the bed would rest on the beanie babies and be at kind of like a teetered angle, and he could see right out his door, and then mm-hmm. things came in. But again, all these were happening when they were children. So aside from the guy who picked it up from somebody else. It seems like this is something that has gone back, just like UFO experiences and other paranormal stuff, seems to have been running through their entire life.
Yeah.
And in some cases, they're like, their parents also had it, because I remember the one woman talking to her mother about it.
Yeah. I wonder if it's a familial thing, you know, in the same way, because, and unfortunately, my youngest daughter seems to be having really profound night terrors.
Oh.
And to the point where, I mean, I think she was 5 years old. Also really crazy, you know, really dense mythological dreams in which she'd tell me about them. I'd be a little shocked that, you know, a five-year-old would be talking about the god Mercury and stuff like this. And it was freaky. But at one point she had come out of one of these, you know, night terrors, and my wife was trying to calm her down. She's like, my wife's saying, what happened? And she, I mean, remember, this is a five-year-old kid. She looked up at my wife and said, you wouldn't understand. You know, I mean, she's like, basically, I can't even explain to you. You wouldn't even understand. And that freaked me out, because, I mean, the stuff started happening to me when I was about her age, roundabout there, is when I started seeing lights in my room and having these paralysis events where I was awake and I would kind of fall down and go unconscious. You know, terrified that there was something in my bedroom. So, you know, to see that happening now to her is heartbreaking to me. You know, I mean, it may be completely unrelated, and it may have nothing to do, you know, or, you know, if I've got my materialist hat on, then I'm thinking that, oh, well, this is, you know, some kind of genetic thing, you know, that's being passed down. But I know the terror that I felt when I was her age, and to think that she might be experiencing similar things is really heartbreaking to me as a parent. You know, what can you do? Yeah, you know, I mean, there's nothing. You know, there's nothing I could do. I mean, as a kid, I had to learn how to deal with this stuff. So, well, you know,
at least having been through it, though, you can try to talk to her about it. Whereas it doesn't sound like you had anyone to really talk to about it.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. I mean, you know, I try to. You know, I try to just be the, you know, the best supportive parent and, you know, try to help her, you know, not fear these experiences so much. But, you know, what can I really do, though? You know, it does feel very, you know, I feel just, you know, helpless to really do much. You know, I mean, if you're having experiences of like entities or whatever, or just plain night terrors, you know, if there's nothing at all, you know, paranormal involved in it, still, you know, there's not much you could do as a parent.
Wait, but Mike, let me ask you this. So what you're saying, so that's, does that mean that you've been, when you were a kid, you were experiencing nightmares frequently?
Yeah. I had night terrors where my mother would come into my bedroom and I would just be screaming with no sound coming out of my mouth. I mean, you know, that terror, that feeling when you're having a nightmare and you're trying to scream and nothing's coming out, you know, just this, it was a regular thing. And yeah.
Okay. So, but at one point, those nightmares became less and less frequent. Can you pinpoint, what age?
Probably, you know, 9 or 10 or something like that.
Okay.
They were pretty regular through my early childhood, you know, and along with the, you know, seeing lights in my room and stuff that was, You know, if the single and again, you know, I have to preface this with this is early childhood. You know, I mean, how much do we really recall clearly from that period? But with that in mind, the several of these experiences feel extremely real to me. And there were numerous occasions where it happened to me as I was walking to my bedroom, and I would see something in my room that was light, and I would fall down on the floor in the hallway and just go out of my bed, go unconscious. Well, until, you know, I'd get back up again. And so you know, for whatever that's worth.
We started this conference by you telling how you started to experiment with melatonin because you wanted to find something that will help you to sleep. So am I correct in saying that after you overcame these night terrors, you then went through a period in which it was difficult for you to fall asleep?
No. This was more starting to use melatonin was more, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, and I was just, you know, having like occasional bouts of insomnia. So I started taking it. And what I really, why I started experimenting with melatonin is because the dreams I was having were so incredible. And I have to say, at one point when I was experimenting with melatonin, I had the first night terror that I had had since I was a kid, which I, you know, I kind of forget about that. But melatonin in general just gave me really vivid, realistic, but also fantastical sort of dreams.
And in my experience, my melatonin dreams are a little bit more insightful than my non-melatonin dreams.
Okay.
As someone who still sort of dips into that pool every now and then whenever I'm feeling like I need a good night's sleep.
So almost as if you reopened a channel in your mind.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good way of looking at it. And, you know, that's what, of course, you know, the way my mind thinks, you know, which has been fueled by, you know, fantasy books and, and the soup, you know, studying the supernatural and the paranormal and all that, you know, my first sort of hypothesis was that melatonin opens some sort of psychic doorway, you know, that allowed whatever, something to come through. And of course, that's obviously one hypothesis for sleep paralysis, is that, you know, something may be happening in your brain, but whatever that's happening is also associated with, you know, some sort of entity also coming into your environment as well.
Yeah.
And before we go any further, I want to say, if anyone listening to this has had experiences like this and want to talk about them, contact me. Go to the website under contact. I think it's stories@wheredidtheroadgo.com. If I get enough, maybe I'll do a whole show on listeners' experiences with night terrors and sleep paralysis. You can also talk about this on the new forum I put up on the wheredidtheroadgo.com. I'll put up a subject for it, and if anyone wants to chime in there, they're welcome to as well. But let's talk about the connections here with the UFO phenomena. As we said at the top, a lot of, you know, debunkers will say, well, that's all, you know, contact experiences are. They're just sleep paralysis. And we know that's not the case. But there are some very striking similarities in these sleep paralysis episodes and abduction experiences. Although the sleep paralysis, you don't usually get them taking people away. They're just coming into the bedroom, but the entity seems similar to some degree. You often get the big eyes. And like UFO experiences, they often run in families. What do we make of that?
Well, there's one other thing that's a commonality of sleep paralysis, and that is people have out-of-body experiences associated with them. You know, which for a long time I was not aware of. You know, I was aware of the intruder stuff, you know, and all the other associated symptoms of sleep paralysis, but I was not aware that it was associated with so many people with out-of-body experiences. And that's, I mean, there you're definitely taught, you know, that adds another layer of similarity to the abduction phenomenon.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing is that a lot of people want to say, well, all abductions must be a function of sleep paralysis, without saying, well, maybe sleep paralysis opens us up to something that the abduction experiences a greater part of.
There you go.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Which is where I personally have sort of landed on the whole thing. And I think that what we're dealing with, honestly, is something akin to something that Soraya and I have talked about a lot, big dreams and small dreams. You know, there are big dreams, which are dreams that are profound and that actually mean something, that are actually tapping into something more significant. And then there are small dreams, which are like, I went down the street and my head was made of jam and I ended up seeing a dog that said hello with the top hat, you know? And I think that sleep paralysis kind of falls into that sort of category as well. It's, some of them are meaningful and some of them are just like, you know, literally just bodily hallucinations. But I can't help but see another through line that happens with a lot of tricksterish supernatural phenomena, is that this is a liminal state. It's a state between wakefulness and sleepfulness. It is the in-between twilight zone that these things like to inhabit.
I think what this, when we try to make these connections, is that, like Joshua proposed, you know, when humans go to sleep, we go and our minds cross this threshold between this reality and other realities that seem to be on those states as valid as our waking reality. So if we entertain this alternative further along, we might go and acknowledge the idea that this reality is also a dream. You know, it's just a much more convincing dream, a much more, you know, resilient dream, but it's also a dream. You know, it's also a dream that we may end up waking up, you know, on some occasions, you know, maybe when we die, or maybe when we go and change our perceptions through the use of psychedelics or other types of meditation or something like that. But yeah, maybe that's the connecting points of all of this.
Absolutely.
Okay. And then, of course, the other factor we get is shadow people. And I myself have seen plenty of shadow people in full waking consciousness without, you know, any kind of liminal state whatsoever.
Yeah.
But that is a very common thing that people see in this paralysis state, is something that, you know, you got the hat man, you got the typical shadow people and things like that. But again, who's to say this is not tapping into something or drawing the attention of something when you're in that state?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because if I hadn't personally seen them for myself outside of any kind of liminal state, I'd say, well, okay, it's just a liminal thing that our brain drags up. But that's not the explanation for what I've seen, and it's the same type of thing.
Can you describe what you saw?
There's been so many of them. I think one of the more striking ones, we were in this graveyard that a lot of weird stuff happened in, and we were playing hide and seek. And I thought it was like two of us looking for two other people. It was the middle of the night. And I thought I saw my friend creeping along the edge of where they have this Civil War memorial. And I'm kind of going to him, psst, hey. And he's not responding. And he's moving real stealthily and real cat-like. And I could see him crystal clear, but it was just a shadow because it was so dark out. And all of a sudden I hear him yell from the other side of the graveyard because he grabbed a hold of one of the other people. And I went, wait a minute, who's that? And as I got closer, it literally just disintegrated. When I went back the next day, when it was daylight out, where this shadow was walking through, you couldn't have walked through. It was all thick bush.
Interesting. Was there a demon monkey there?
No, that was
that's giving you a hard time.
What's a pet cemetery?
You know, sometimes
and
I wonder.
Now we know that Sarai is the type of guy who plays hide and seek at night in cemeteries.
You wouldn't have thought that, would you?
You know, I like the idea that sleep paralysis is the consciousness equivalent of getting stalled in a bad neighborhood. You know, it's like if you just keep moving, you're going to be fine. But if your car engine kicks out at this one point, you're going to be stuck amongst some people who are less than savory. But things like that, where you're completely conscious, it implies that there is something else going on in terms of the shadow person phenomena.
And the interesting thing about that spot, I mean, like I said, a lot of weird stuff happened to that graveyard. I was walking through with a girl a couple of years ago who was just starting to be able to pick things up here and there. And I never told her that story. And as we walked through that area, there's like the memorial's on like the right. From the left-hand side, she literally watched a shadow person walk out of the graves, get to the middle of the not walkway, it's like bad driveway, I guess you could say, you know, partially paved. And then just disappear. And I'd never seen this girl afraid of anything. And she just stopped and turned white. And I stopped and she was about to bolt. And I'm like, what? She's like, okay, just saw a shadow person disappear in front of me.
Jesus. Well, it's funny. You go on like haunted house. You go on ghost hunting expeditions. And a lot of times they'll say, oh, I saw a shadow person poking his head out the door. And I've been on one of these and I didn't see Jack. But I think that's a very different – I think something about that is very different than what you see in the hypnagogic sleep state. I think the what you see in the sleep paralysis state is a lot more tangible than what you – like, because whenever you're in that sort of – I mean, obviously, if you're going out ghost hunting in a creepy old abandoned sanatorium or something, you're primed to see something, you know.
True.
But if you're in that – if you're wanting to sleep, you might not necessarily be, you know, open to that happening.
Well, you know, when we were playing hide and seek, I was not primed to see anything.
Exactly.
Then. I didn't think I was seeing anything.
Sure.
And here's the other thing. They've always appeared like, I always describe them as liquid darkness.
Oh.
Because they don't look like a shadow necessarily. It's just that they're blacker than black, like they're sucking in the light. Mm. But it's not, like if you look at a shadow, it doesn't have really defined edges.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But these things always seem to have very defined edges, like it's a ball of black.
Mm.
Which is wild.
You know, I think the most disturbing thing that this documentary and the idea of shadow people and the sleep paralysis seems to propose is something that I encountered first while reading the work of Carlos Castañeda. The idea that we inhabit a predatory universe and there are things out there that see us the same way that we might see a chicken, you know, or a rabbit or something. That we, when we are asleep or something, we become vulnerable and we are easy prey for entities that may be lurking out there, you know, in these twilight stages. Mm-hmm. And the thing that is disturbing is, okay, so what happened? Obviously, these people in this documentary, they're able to tell their stories because eventually they woke up, you know, right. So they weren't vulnerable anymore. But what happened when you die? You know, what happened? Mm-hmm. Does that make you more vulnerable? Do you become then, do you fall into some entity's nest? And you're ready then for the
picking. Oh, that's a creepy thought, man.
I know. That's
well, you know, it from a magician's perspective, you know, at least the Western magical traditions, but also, you know, shamanic traditions and, you know, Eastern magical traditions too. I mean, you know, when you're in an altered state, you are vulnerable. You know, that's why, you know, in the Western magical traditions, you do banishings, you know, you cleanse the environment because there are all these things out there, you know, whether they call them parasites or just, beasties, I think, you know, in any magician's training, you learn that when you start practicing magic, you know, they in some tradition, I think the Golden Dawn tradition, you know, it's you're lighting up the astral, you know, when you're doing these rituals and things. Suddenly, on other levels of reality, things are starting to pay attention to you. Yeah. And it's a great analogy, Josh, about, you know, being caught in a you know, in a bad neighborhood, you know. And I think of it that way, you're caught, you know, if you're psychically, you know, attuned or in some sort of altered state or whatever occurs during sleep paralysis, it's like you're in the bad neighborhood, but you're wearing a flashy suit, you know, and walking around looking at your iPhone glowing in your face, you know, and this is making kind of a broader sort of analysis of, I guess, what I would call like a paranormal prone personality. And that's, you know, if you're the type of person who's likely to have sleep paralysis, you know, maybe you're also a person who's likely to see, you know, these dark entities or shadow people or whatever you want to call them. And, you know, so maybe you're just kind of walking around a little more lit up than other people are. And because of that, you draw the attention of, you know, the low lifes in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, right. In which case, you know, I mean, imagine, you know, put yourself in the low life's shoes, you know, if they wear shoes, you know, yeah, there, here's suddenly, you know, you're just doing your thing in your dark domain, and here somebody lights up because they're having this physiological experience that also happens to have a psychic component. And what are you going to do? You know, you're going to go where that light is. You're going to check that out. You know, here's a juicy morsel to feast on.
Well, and if
you feed on fear, you know, if you feed on negativity, man, you know, hey, there's some guy having sleep paralysis. I know exactly where I'm going.
Well, and I would brazenly speculate that perhaps this happens more often than we realize. If you've got a monkey on your back, maybe you got that monkey in some sort of transitory state, you know. Maybe you've got, you know, that small addiction or that temptation that you're feeding is something that sort of latched onto you at some point.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of, like, sort of, you know, psychic parasites has always seemed, you know, really logical to me. You know, if we are to, you know, if we consider the possibility that there are non-corporeal entities out there, you know, I mean, you know, there are parasitical, you know, bacteria everywhere. There's viruses, there's bugs, there's mosquitoes, you know, ticks. Mm-hmm. You know, why wouldn't the astral or etheric realm be full of these things too?
And I got the impression when I was watching it that some of these people felt like this stuff was just hunting them after a while as well, which fits that sort of archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Something that really interested me, something that interests me in general is just the idea of how other senses play into the sleep paralysis narrative. I've talked on here before about how people who experience sleep paralysis, if they are nearsighted, will sometimes report that the entities are blurrier the farther away they are, which to me suggests some sort of objective component. But I also found it really interesting some of the aural aspects that some people reported in this particular documentary. One of them was the banging sound. Has anybody here ever experienced that, banging or buzzing?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
But that's also a very common symptom of Kundalini.
And abductions.
Yeah. And I would throw in there, like, the one lady was talking about, the tapping at her window is evocative of Sasquatch encounters and poltergeist encounters.
Yeah,
too.
And Whitley Strieber, you know, he talks about just the three knocks or the three series of three knocks, but when he would meditate, and that this little being came in, the one that he smelled, you know, he held this thing's hand and smelled it. It would always start with bumps on his seat, on the roof. He'd hear a little like pounding on the roof as if things were dropping onto the roof. So yeah, Joshua, I A while back when we were talking about doing this particular podcast, I started looking at studies of sleep paralysis. And as far as the auditory element of it, what I found fascinating, and it was in the documentary that I just watched tonight, is the fact that a lot of the time, I think it's the majority of the time, when people describe hearing these things talk to them, it's in gibberish. Or some strange, weird language. It's not often, and one of the guys said that in this film. But often, when these entities talk, it's just kind of nonsensical, gibberish kind of language, which I found that really fascinating. And that's when you look at studies, that's what most people report when they hear something talking to them. It's often not just a straightforward message. It's just kind of like bizarre language that they're talking.
And you know, I hate to keep on banging this drum, but two thoughts really sort of come to me. Number one is the idea that some people report to have heard Sasquatch speaking gibberish in the woods. The Sierra Sounds is actually a great example of someone who claims to have caught what they call quote unquote samurai chatter, because it sounds like bad Kurosawa translation. But it's always this unintelligible sort of noises of seeming like speech in the woods. But I also think about McKenna's ideas on the importance of glossolalia, the importance of the idea that meaning can be conveyed without actual enunciation of specific words. And I wonder if that might have some sort of meaning to this whole phenomena as well. You know, the idea that, like, speaking in tongues in a lot of the ecstatic traditions, you know, the idea that the meaning is what's more important than the actual medium in which it's presented.
You know, or in Western magical traditions, it's the barbarous languages.
Yes, yes.
You know, that's the same sort of thing, that you're conveying meaning in what sounds like nonsensical language.
Yeah, in Grant Morrison's comic series, The Invisibles, they talk about glossolalia as the primordial language. You know, it's a language that is, it acquires whatever meaning you need, you know, from your own particular subconscious. You know, kind of like, well, the UFO phenomenon. If you if you go along with Greg Bishop's idea that the UFO phenomenon is akin to an artistic, to an art project, you know, you look at a piece of art, and you see the art conveys a different meaning to you that from the meaning that I may receive from it, you know, because of my particular background, you know. So maybe that's the same way that in which we interpret these entities. We talk about, okay, seeing shadow people with hats, you know, kind of like 1940s kind of hats. Does that mean that people in, I don't know, Africa or in Japan or in China, do they see different hats, you know, worn by these shadow entities? Or, you know, are there different cultural perceptions in all of this?
Or as America's colonialism fades, does the fedora go away and get replaced by something different?
But as hipsters begin wearing them, see, it's back.
One of the more interesting cases, I think, on that documentary was the guy who was sleeping with two girls there. And
like
in a small apartment, but, you know. Anyway, he's... He starts having this thing that he said looked like the Mothman. He said it was so tall it had a duck down in his building. It had glowing red eyes.
Glowing red eyes, yeah.
And he doesn't, you know, and it's telling him it's going to kill him, it's going to do this, and it's just threatening him. And the girl next to him wakes up, which I think was his girlfriend, wakes up, and she sees this black cat on her chest with red eyes, staring at him, but she's not understanding what it's saying, but it sounds threatening to her. So the question there becomes, was there something there that was outside of them that both of them saw in different ways but conveyed a similar sort of feeling? Or was he projecting something outwardly that was so strong that she was picking it up?
Before we go there, I think it's important to acknowledge the fact that he had enough of a cultural context to say, kind of like Mothman.
Right.
I think that, that's significant. And I'm not necessarily casting aspersions upon what he was saying, but I think that that is a really interesting little nugget. Now, discuss.
Yeah, I immediately thought the same thing. Like, wow, this guy's done quite a bit of reading.
Well, I guess. Great.
I mean, I would hope that you would, if you have half a brain. You know, I mean, these things are happening to you. Wouldn't you try to explore? That's also what fascinates me is when people say they've had sleep paralysis all their lives, but yet they never knew what it was.
Yeah,
you know, that strikes me as like, don't you think about this? Don't you think to pick up a book or something, or look this up? You know, it's that's always odd. But maybe there are people who just kind of cruise through life without really, trying to figure out what's going on inside their heads. I don't know.
I think it's a cultural thing. When you go in the morning, to your work and the office, and what is the kind of conversations you have with your coworkers? You talk about maybe the movie that you saw last night on Netflix, or the game that was transmitted do you discuss your dreams with your coworkers, with your friends, with your family members? No, it's something that we keep to ourselves. It's private. It's almost shameful to discuss, particularly if it's something disturbing. So most people try to, keep that aspect of their life up to themselves.
But now you have that semi anonymity of the internet, though.
That's true. Yeah.
One of the things I also found interesting with that is I don't know how to exactly explain it, but I'm wondering if it was something that was spreading to this girl, because it seemed like she was having the same type of experience. But it also, in that case, was sort of the nightmare hag, because it was sitting on her chest.
But a cat, too, and that's another odd aspect is some of these surveys that they've done of sleep paralysis. Sometimes people think that it's someone like that they know, or a pet that they have or something like that, so you might think it's your cat coming up and sitting on you. That's what I flashed to when I saw that. But it's really fascinating that that here she's seeing a cat. He's seeing this giant 8-foot-tall humanoid with, Mothman-like laser red eyes at the same time. Was she – what made her see the cat? What made him see this giant humanoid? That's the $64,000 question, I guess.
And then you have the fact that you have so many people who have seen red-eyed monsters in perfectly normal states of consciousness all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you have that crossover of, okay, these things don't just appear in sleep paralysis. They appear in normal, what we could call normal reality as well.
Mm-hmm. And what about, why aren't they ever, green eyes,
What is red?
I wonder how much of that is because, if you ask someone to make up a monster, they're going to give it red eyes.
Well, to be fair, whether you run into
that's folklorical, or whether that's how these things manifest.
You do run into green and green-eyed Sasquatch and Dogman reports every now and then, but for the most part, it's red-eyed.
I have a person close to me who had a shadow person experience, and he reported it to have. He told me that, and obviously this is something cultural, that he kind of resembled like the Marvel character Venom, right? So it's a shadowy person, you know, almost like the person in this documentary with this really big mouth, you know, this really grinning, grotesque mouth. And he reported it having yellow eyes.
Well, and Venom isn't too far removed from the gray alien image either, you know?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is something that was also portrayed in the documentary, which I think was really interesting. All these people seeing parallels or hints about this experience in popular culture.
Yes.
I think one of these people interviewed in the documentary saw this like intro, this very surrealistic intro in the movie Natural Born Killers. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, in that the end of that intro shows like this shadowy figure, right? And so to the point that he wondered if the person who produced this sequence for the film experienced that. And it's also obviously Wes Craven, you know, famous Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, and you have this terrorific entity, you know, Freddy Krueger, who enters into his victim's dreams, and he's wearing a fedora, of course. So the problem with that is that skeptics are so fond of telling, oh well, obviously this is the result of people being influenced by all these pop culture elements. But someone like Jeffrey Kripal will be quick to point out that there is this chicken and the egg conundrum of these artistic entities being these artistic persons, writers and artists and painters being inspired by their own personal experiences. So they use that for their work, which is further injected into the popular culture. So this is all this cross pollination going back and forth, back and forth, you know.
Co-creation, really.
Exactly.
You know, and we you touched on Wes Craven, I mean, he allegedly, you know, thought up the idea of A Nightmare on Elm Street after he read what was happening to the Hmong population in the U.S. having an extraordinary rash of people dying in their sleep.
Yeah.
And blaming it on, you know, I forget the name of their particular name for the sleep paralysis entity, but, you know, I mean, you know, talk about art imitating life and then life imitating art until you get into this big, you know, just like you said, Red Pill. I mean, you know, how much are we, you know, building this thing, you know, as it's working off of us.
I totally lost what I was just going to say. You were talking earlier, Josh, about, you know, these people. I think it was you, Josh, who was saying these people have all told us stories because they haven't died.
No, I think it was Miguel.
Was it Miguel? Okay. Yeah. But the one guy did die. He got shot in one of the experiences, one of the really weird experiences, found himself just kind of like stuck there for a very long period of time. Where he eventually was able to shake back out of it, but as far as he knew, he thought he was dead.
Well, and that prolapsed time period brings to mind... I'm sorry, I feel like I say the same things over and over again. It brings to mind missing time. It brings to mind being trapped in Fairyland. It brings to mind the time prolation that people experience during the effects of DMT.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Sorry if I keep on banging that drum again, but it's I feel like it rears its head often.
And some of the notes you made on it, Red Pill, like the laser show could be similar to entopic phenomenon.
Which I have had experience many, many times.
Mm-hmm. There was something else in here you attributed to that, too. But there definitely seems to be some connections to that type of... that type of thing as well. Wish I could find the other note I just found of yours.
can I throw something in, Soraya? Because I'm going to I'm going to forget it if I don't get it out right now. But I mean, we think of sleep paralysis as just kind of this aberration, you know, in the modern world. But couldn't this really be where religion came from? Couldn't this be where our whole conception of the paranormal, of supernatural entities?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is deep stuff. You know, I mean, these are experiences that scare the living crap out of, you know, modern, you know, 21st century people who, you know better than to believe in spooky things, you know, coming into their bedrooms. Imagine what this must have been like, you know, a long, long, long time ago when human beings are having these experiences.
Yeah,
I think it certainly, does that make sense? You know,
totally makes sense.
I think it certainly probably reinforced beliefs that were already established from interacting with the world around them. You know, animism plus sleep paralysis probably gives you something like druidic thought, I would think.
Yeah.
Not only that, but there are two cases here. One where the woman like prayed to Jesus or whatever, and it didn't change anything. Uh-huh. The other did the same thing and it went away completely.
And she became a Christian.
Yeah. And she was essentially an atheist because she said that a medium or a psychic had told her she would marry a Christian man, and she scoffed at it. And she's like, yeah, I don't see that ever happening. And then after this experience, she became Christian and ended up marrying a Christian man. But what this makes me think, I mean, if it was as simple as that, just praying to Jesus and these things would go away, hence their demons, it would work for everybody.
Right, right.
But it doesn't. So is this a control factor? Are they trying to push? Were they trying to push her that way for some reason?
Yeah, and of course there are people in the alien abduction
field. Yes.
Who say, you know, that saying the name of Jesus when these entities are coming to get you, you know, it scares them away, you know?
Yeah. I have a friend who has had these type of experiences, and what he would see would be grays coming in and getting ready to take him away, and he started doing the very same thing. He would pray to Jesus, and they would go away, and they've stopped since then. And he's become very religious because of this, which is fully understandable. But like I said, is it a control factor?
Being my typical iconoclastic Christian self, I would love to think that if an atheist says, Jesus, help me, it will absolutely help them. And if a fundamentalist says, Jesus, help me, it won't do a damn thing.
you know, it's funny. I think I talked about on a show a while back that I had this really terrifying sort of lucid, it felt like an entity attack after I'd been reading a bunch of Enochian magic books before I went to bed. And reading them out loud in my head. And I just read Lon Milo Duquette's autobiographical book. It's like My Life Among Spirits, I think it's called. So my brain was really kind of cooking on this stuff. And I was reading the Enochian names aloud in my head. You know, I wasn't sitting there in bed, you know, my wife next to me reading, you know, ooh, my God, you know, that sort of thing. But I was reading them aloud in my head, and then I had a really terrifying lucid dream. It was a dream at first that I was in a house, and something was knocking on the door. It was like an old farmhouse sort of house, like one shown in the film tonight. And as I opened the door, something growled.
Whoa.
And tried to push the door in. And when that happened, I became lucid in the dream. And I'm like, oh, my God, I've got it. And I'm trying to shut the door. And this thing is trying to push its way in. And this is not the first time it's happened. I mean, lapsed Catholic boy that I am. And I don't really consider myself a Christian. But I love the Christian spiritual tradition. Yeah. I love the Christian stories and all that. But, man, whenever something like that happens to me, when that happened that night, I went back to Jesus, man. I mean, I found the Lord.
Came back to the flock.
Yes, I was. I mean, I was
in a rush.
And I was absolutely terrified. I mean, that moment was as terrifying as the sleep paralysis moment I've had. But this was like a lucid dream where I really felt like I was battling something that was really, really bad. And man, so I was saying like the Our Father, and I was pulling out everything. I was mentally doing like banishing pentagrams and all this. I was throwing the kitchen sink at this thing, you know. So and it felt as real as if, you know, someone was pounding on my door right now trying to get in the house. So you know, I don't know. It whatever it was, I got it. I got out of that state, you know, whether it was calling on Jesus or what, I certainly wouldn't rule it out. You know, well, I mean, you know, there might be names of power, you know, there might be words that work or something, you know, who's it? I would not discount being able to do something like that.
I would tend
Save
to think
me, Hulk.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was saying that instead of speaking the name of Jesus, I will speak the name of Hulk, you know? You know that he can beat the crap out of any puny.
Yes. Captain America, please help me. Now, I would like to think, and this is not towing the Christian line as most popular culture has it, but I would like to think that any positive spiritual tradition would have a sort of power in that sort of situation. And the invocation of the names of positive spiritual leaders would produce a similar effect. Because I think that's really what it is. It's about the effect and the faith that is generated in the speaker or believer. That's I'll let it go at that, because I don't want to turn it into the touchy-feely yeah. demonic
Josh
explosion podcast.
Power hour.
Yeah, exactly. Bedtime Bible chat.
Yeah, the strength of the archetype.
Yeah.
Maybe this. Yeah. Well, consider this. Maybe this woman. Let's play with the idea that these things come from within us. Maybe when this psychic told her she'd, you know, marry a Christian, eventually she believed it. And this experience happened that she generated internally to push her in that direction.
Hmm. Yeah. That's certainly possible too. I mean, but then we're back at that, you know, that critical point, you know, are these things of us and generated by us, or do they have a separate existence?
Well, here's the other thing. So when David Weatherly wrote his book on Black Eyed Children,
yeah.
The one thing he noticed is that the only similarity he found in people who had these experiences is that 99% of them were not religious at all. They were not spiritual people. They were not religious people. They weren't necessarily atheists.
Hmm.
They just didn't have any religious. And after these encounters happened, a lot of them moved a little more toward religion and spirituality than they were before, because it scared the crap out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Then you look at things like Fatima and Virgin Mary appearances, all which have the telltale marks of UFO encounters.
Right.
And then you really got to start thinking control system at this point. What are they trying to push us to? What are they trying to, you know, orient us towards?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, going back to the question of whether these are internally generated or externally generated, the mystic in me will answer that, you know, there's no difference.
Yes, well, that's very true, very true.
Uh-huh.
So there was one thing on the nightmare where the woman was talking about having an experience after her mother died. And it was a positive experience for her, unlike all these other ones. And then that, to me, suggests some, you know, that there suggests a little bit that it's coming from her. But maybe not. I mean, maybe the dead can access this realm the same way these other spirits can, if they're external as rather than internal.
Well, then we get back into the UFO. We get back into, you know, Strieber, and you know his when Anne Strieber was reading through all these, you know, all the letters that were coming into them, she was like, "Hey, the dead have something to do with this."
Yes.
Yes. Well, I mean, what I'm seeing from all this phenomena, from these night terrors, from this sleep paralysis, is that it somehow connects in with all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as simple as the body just shuts down while the mind stays awake.
Mm-hmm.
Or the body goes, or part of your brain goes into a sleep state while the rest of it stays awake. It makes sense on the surface, but the more of these stories I hear, the less, you know, sense that it makes that it's just a brain thing.
Well, I would, you know, I think we draw, we draw a line there where there doesn't have to be a line drawn. Mm-hmm. And that just because there is a physical correlate in the brain does not mean that there's not something else happening at the same time.
Very true.
You know, like if you put me in a, you know, and, you know, it's like if you put me in a functional MRI scanner and show me a cupcake or, you know, a picture of a beautiful woman or something, or a picture of a beautiful woman holding a cupcake, even better, you know, there are going to be changes in my brain. And, you know, you can't say that those changes in my brain caused the picture of the beautiful woman with a cupcake, you know? So just because there's something happening in our minds that is chemical, electrochemical, does not mean that there's not also something objectively happening that's related to those physiological changes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I was trying to say that, yeah, the same, like, if you go with psychedelic experiences, mm-hmm. and if you, obviously, there is a physical component with psychedelic experiences, there's the ingestion of psychedelics,
mm-hmm.
but think that if science were trying to explain psychedelic experiences by only what happens with your stomach, how you break down all the chemicals and how it then goes and are passed on in your veins, you know, goes and goes through the brain barrier and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's only part of it, you know. There you have to go beyond of that, right?
Yeah.
You know.
Yep.
Yeah. And
there's a great analogy, Sasha Shulgin. I think it's in Pical, the book he mm-hmm. wrote about psychedelic phenethylamines. He says, you know, he talks about the first time he tried ecstasy or MDMA that, you know, he basically made in his lab. And he's, you know, he had this profound experience that, you know, cleansed his soul and made him have a fresh look on life and, you know, made him think about the people he knew and loved and all this. And he's like, that wasn't in that 150 milligrams of powder. You know, those experiences are not in that powder. Yeah. That drug I took is just a catalyst for something in my consciousness. Like, my consciousness did all the other stuff. The powder didn't do that. The powder doesn't contain my soul, you know, my ability to, you know, think about all the people I know and my life and, you know, all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. It's not in that little capsule, you know, that's in me.
Yeah, the powder was only a catalyst.
Exactly.
You know, and this reminds me of something, the research of Carla Turner, you know, Dr. Carla Turner. Was into investigating abduction experiences, and she ended up with a very negative view on the whole phenomenon. And one of the things that I found curious in her research was how she was always very hesitant or very dismissive of the claims of these entities that they were trying to, you know, do something spiritual, you know, elevating the spirituality of the people who were experiencing these visitations. And the way she explained it away or dismissed it away is, oh, you cannot go and have an spiritual experience, you know, with a physical, you know, sexual or physical encounter. And my answer to that is, sure you can. I mean, we are just talking about how you can have a physical experience like, I don't know, ingesting a mushroom, you know, taking a tab of acid, or maybe even have making love to your spouse or your lover. And obviously that is a physical component, but that leads way to a very, could lead that way to a very meaningful, very profound spiritual experience. And I think it's the problem with our current Western society that tries to separate the spiritual world from the physical world, you know? And there are many cultures, like, I don't know, shamanic cultures, in which they don't make those distinctions. They take the whole enchilada, as it were, you know? you have a spiritual experiences through physical interactions and the other way around.
No, oh, absolutely. There was an interesting story in Jim Harold's latest book, and I had him talk about it. I don't remember if I had him talking about it on the main show or in the Patreon-only section. I think it was on the main show, where this woman had dreamed, she was at her boyfriend's or whatever in college, and she fell asleep, and she had this dream of a black shadow moving across the ceiling, going toward the light switch, and she dreamed her boyfriend woke up and said, you know, turn off the light or turn on the light or whatever. And then, you know, she woke up all scared and freaked out, and when she fell back asleep, she had another dream about this dark shadow. And I think she grabbed the light switch at the same time the shadow got to the light switch or something, and she got an electrical shock go through her.
Oh.
And at the same time, her boyfriend was having almost the same dream.
Mm.
Interesting.
Yeah, and the shared dream thing is not something that is all that uncommon. I mean, I know a very Christian couple who, she had a dream that he was running the Alaskan Mafia and was running up the stairs to choke her, and she had the dream she had the dream that he was running the Alaskan Mafia, and he had the dream that he was running the Alaskan Mafia, whatever the Alaskan Mafia is, and was and he was running up the stairs to choke her, and he actually woke up choking her, and they both said that their dreams correlated in that way. Very, very close friends of mine and my wife.
Oh,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
I think Sarah Palin is involved in the Alaska.
Oh, yes, and
Iditarod racing.
Because they can see Russia from there.
You betcha.
Which, you know, and if you can share a dream, and I've had that experience numerous times, what does that say about it? I mean, what?
Yeah.
It's not obviously an internal component if you're sharing a dream with someone, if you're having two pieces of the same dream. All right, so what else can we say about this? Any other thoughts, guys?
I don't know, but
we've exhausted quite a bit of this topic,
we've already established that night terrors are a very, very common thing, whether people openly express it or openly acknowledge that they have them is another matter entirely. And it's kind of ironic, you know, we're trying to find alien beings by using telescopes, you know, and trying to use radio telescopes and all of that. And we may be having visitations from entities from another realms just by going to sleep, you know, and putting our heads on a pillow. And I don't know, the thing is that we haven't established a way to try to, I don't know, protect yourself from these visitations, which seem to be really, for the most part, malintentioned in nature.
Right. Mm-hmm. And whether they're actually malintentioned or if that's just the way we're reacting to them.
Okay, good point.
If we're co-creating them, I mean, it could be either one.
Yeah.
But what I think is interesting, if you look at if you tell a nut and bolt UFO guy, hey, look at, you know, sleep paralysis, they'll say that has nothing to do with UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
But as we've been going through here and showing, there are so many similarities, which, of course, is one of the reasons the debunkers will use it as the explanation, but maybe they're not realizing that there may be more to the sleep paralysis than just the disconnect in the brain. There may actually be some interaction going on.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a really good point. This could be the real, you know, this could be the real linchpin of alien abductions. You know, I mean, this could be the way we finally begin to understand it as objective and subjective at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this sleep paralysis, instead of being shoveled, you know, to the side by, you know, the nuts and bolters, at the same time it's being, you know, pushed as the answer by the skeptics. I mean, maybe this is the real thing that brings both views together.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah,
sleep paralysis definitely plays a part, but it's not like they think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly. And my takeaway from the whole thing would be that no one who is involved in any of these subjects, and I don't really care at this point what it is, anything that is unexplained, that is not, you know, what were the origins of, you know, ethnicity X or Y or Z, anyone involved in non-materialistic speculation cannot deny that these things are not connected, and cannot close themselves off to the possibility that sleep paralysis might have a lot to do with spirit phenomena, might have a lot to do with alien abduction phenomena as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the other takeaway is really that we are closer to these things than we think. Mm-hmm. That they are just a hair's breadth away from our everyday reality.
Yeah.
And truly, it is an altered state of consciousness. No matter what is actually physically going on in the brain, what it is an altered state. Just mm-hmm. like if you took DMT or something like that and had other, you know, experiences where you're experiencing what seem to be objective entities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The soberest person in the world has experienced altered states of consciousness. Just the way human condition.
Yep.
It seems to be a fundamental part of the human condition. I want to... Mm-hmm. get back to this, what we were saying earlier, that this seems to have been, this could have very well have been the trigger of religion mm-hmm. in human culture, not the typical materialistic explanation of you know, caveman seeing, you know, thunderbolts falling onto the ground and saying, oh my God, you know, the gods are right. Maybe these are reasons that we started to believe in angels and demons and gods and whatnot.
Sure, and if you're living in a cave or sleeping out in some kind of shelter in the woods, you're not having the bedroom experience, but you're seeing these beings come to you while you're sleeping, and they're communicating with you or scaring you or helping you in some way and then going away. I mean, who knows how they reacted to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe this is the reason why they started to paint in the caves, you know, to try to fend off these entities, you know.
Right.
Well, consider with our culture, we take anything like that as negative. You know, ghosts mm-hmm. are scary. UFOs are here to hurt us. Bigfoot wants to do whatever mm-hmm. Bigfoot wants to do to us. So anything we don't understand, we immediately put into the scary, harmful category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But maybe back in those days, they didn't. They felt like this was the spirits talking to them, and they needed to listen. So maybe they didn't have negative experiences with them, or if they did, they tried to learn from them.
Well, and I've often argued, and not to spin us off on a separate tangent, but I've often argued that the concept of the second sleep that was very common in ages past, where people would wake up in the middle of the night and spend that time awake and in prayer or in contemplation, might actually be a defense against this sort of phenomena, too.
Yeah. Oh, that could be as well.
Yeah, maybe the entity, we are perceiving the phenomenon in such a negative way because maybe these entities are trying to shake us up from our current state of slumber. I mean, if you are riding along to a person who is driving up and you see that he's falling asleep, you're not like saying, "Hey, wake up!" You know, you're not being gentle. You shake him up. You know, you slap him and say, "Hey, man! You know, check out!" You know,
that's a great analogy. Yeah,
I
I have a two takeaways personally, and that is the kind of more prosaic one is that if it turns out, you know, or if we want to go along with the idea that sleep paralysis opens the door to these bad things that come and scare the crap out of us. Well, first of all, we must be pretty powerful because they've yet to kill, you know, I'm knocking on wood, you know, several layers of wood right now. You know, but most people get scared, but they do wake up. And, you know, so these things might be terrifying, but they don't seem to be able to actually puncture the barrier and get through and drag us to hell like I felt this thing was going to do to me. And the second is I kept thinking of Rudolf Otto, who was a Lutheran theologian. And in the early 20th century, and he's the guy that coined the numinous. When we talk about these entities or these sorts of experiences, but it gets kind of misused now compared to the way he used the term. If numinous is a confrontation with the other, and the other can be terrifying. I mean, the other can be demonic. It can scare the living hell out of us. We don't, because it's so alien to us. We don't understand it. It can be that same other that we meet in like a profound spiritual experience. But it's that, I think he coined the term the mysterium, the tremendous and fascinating mystery. But it's also, it's also terrifying, you know, like when you see the face of God, like the Hebrew prophets, you know, they would fall down in terror, you know, Ezekiel seeing the wheel, you know, I mean, all these, you know, when you break through and you see God or the other or the mystery, it's not always a pleasant experience, you know, so these numinous experiences of sleep paralysis, you know, while they feel very demonic to a lot of people, you know, maybe it's just an expression of something bigger that just terrifies us because it's different. And I'm sketchy on, you know, going with that because my own personal experience is it did not feel holy, you know, in any way. It feels absolutely dark and malevolent and evil. But maybe that's what the other seems like to us.
Yeah, I don't know.
But if we entertain the existence of evil and darkness and shadow, that also denotes the existence of light and goodness, you know?
Yes, yes.
There cannot be one without the other.
You are a mystic, Red Pill.
and to add to that, maybe one brings about the other.
Exactly.
Yep.
I tend to think that there are two sides of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
But anyway, overall, I'd recommend people check out The Nightmare.
Yes.
It was an excellent docudrama. Yes. And as I said, you can find it on Netflix. I'm sure anywhere else. I don't know who released it exactly, but it didn't seem like it had a huge budget, but it was done exceptionally well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And Soraya definitely let people know about your forum that you just opened, and I'll get to. I would love to hear stories from anyone who's listening who's had interesting, scary or otherwise sleep paralysis, you know.
I'm going to put up a thing in the forum that people can conversate about this. You can tell your stories in there if you want. If you'd like to tell your story on the air, you can shoot me an email. I think it's stories@wheredidtheroadgo.com. It'll be in the contact section of the website, which is wheredidtheroadgo.com. And if I get a few of them, I'll do a little separate show just on night terrors and sleep paralysis stories. I know I had one. I think it was the last listener's stories. The pastor or the priest, he wasn't a priest. I think he was a pastor who had the sleep paralysis where it pressed him down into his couch, and he found out later that two of the slats underneath the couch had gotten broken from it.
Wow.
Mm.
So again, you had another physical type of evidence there, because he said, you know, you could have bounced on that, you know, basically you could have bounced on that couch, those things weren't going to break, but he felt it just shoving him down into it.
Mm.
But yeah, so do that, and if you want to talk in the forum, you feel free to add your own forum subjects. There's someone's already put up an entry for guest suggestions, if you'd like to hear someone on the show.
Cool.
Obviously, nice. I can't just get anyone I want. That would be nice. if that were the case, we'd have Jacques Vallée tomorrow.
Don't help.
Keep at yeah. it, Raya. Yeah, I mean, you've had, I mean, as far as, you know, podcasts on this subject, you've had some of the best guests that I'm aware of, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel pretty lucky to have gotten some of the people I've gotten, people I didn't think would ever talk, you know, I've never heard on interviews like Patrick Harper and stuff where I was just like, well, this isn't going to happen, but I'll try anyway, and he was like, sure.
Yeah, nice.
So you never know. We do have, let's see. We have Jeffrey Kripal coming up in May.
All right.
Nice.
Michael's going to be helping me with that one, since you're very familiar with his work. And that may end up being a two-parter, actually, because I'm guessing that's not going to go quickly.
It should be.
Nice.
I have the author of Illuminations. What's his name? Eric Olay?
I believe so, yeah. Wallet, maybe? My French.
Eric Wallet, yeah.
Yeah, my French Canadian's not so good these days.
Yeah.
So in the next couple of weeks, very soon, he'll be on to talk about his theory on UFOs, which is really unique and has more to do with poltergeist phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And some other stuff I'm still working on. Still waiting to hear back from some people.
Nice.
But it should be interesting. We're going to have some very unique guests, and I think Kripal will definitely be a...
Oh, yeah. That'll be a highlight. Yeah.
He's just put out his book with Whitley Strieber, and it's from what I've read of it so far, it's very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
All right, any last thoughts, guys?
Oh, speaking of good books, you know, Greg Bishop,
yes,
finally released his book, It Defies Language.
Yes.
So if you want to have a conversation with a fascinating guest to talk about,
yes,
UFOs from a completely... non-dogmatic, unorthodox point of view, well, I can't recommend anyone better than Greg.
Well, yes, I'll have Greg on as soon as I get to read his book. So,
and I would interject that someone is being far too humble because Red Pill Junkie did their illustrations for that book. So, and
he
did? Fantastic. He did. this Red Pill Junkie fellow. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a great cover, man.
Thanks, man.
It's a beautiful book.
Yeah, it's a very cool cover. All right, so I guess we're done for this week. I thank you guys.
Hey, again, man, thank you for giving us the opportunity. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely.
And people out there, tell us your sleep paralysis and night terror stories. We want to hear them.